Welcome to We Dig Metal Evolution, a special Let It Roll maxi-series discussing Sam Dunn's Metal Evolution documentary series hosted by Nate Wilcox with Eugene S. Robinson of the art punk band Oxbow and entertainment lawyer Alexi Auld. Let It Roll is the insanely ambitious musical history podcast. We've covered the early history of rock and roll, country music in the 20th century, the rise of hip-hop, disco, and electronic dance music, and now heavy metal. Stay tuned for our histories of Broadway, opera, punk rock, jazz, blues, and gospel. Follow the Let It Roll podcast on Twitter, at Let It Rollcast, and check out our website at letitrollpodcast.com. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to more great podcasts at www.pantheonpodcasts.com. Today, Nate, Eugene, and Alexi discuss shock rock, a made-up genre that Sam Dunn used to lump together Alice Cooper, Marilyn Manson, Slipknot, and several other acts with a knack for theatrical antics. Email us at letitrollpodcast@gmail.com. Pop in those earbuds and enjoy.
It's time to let it roll. I'm your host, Nate Wilcox, and we're back again with Alexi Auld and Eugene S. Robinson to continue our discussion of Sam Dunn's Metal Evolution series that aired on VH1 a few years back. The ninth episode kind of invents a subgenre he calls shock rock, which includes artists with a strong visual element to their stage shows. Guys, do we buy shock rock as a separate genre worthy of its own episode? No. Alexi?
I mean, because of what? They had to keep stuff out to put stuff in.
Yes. Yep. And they took really... It's funny, you can tell because the episodes in which he has to go way back and handle genres that really... Yes, they were influential, but a totally different music genre, you know? So it goes exactly what Eugene said. So it's what's kept out, and then also how long they have to dwell on certain things.
Yeah. I think the rationale for this was they wanted to cover Marilyn Manson pretty heavily. Like 10 years ago when this came out, Marilyn Manson was a bigger deal than he is now. Yep. 20 years, he was even bigger deal. And Manson doesn't quite fit in a category. Like I had thought he kind of fit in with industrial with like Nine Inch Nails or White Zombie or whatever. But going back and listening to the records, at least the first couple records are pretty much straight guitar rock. And then he gets more industrial-ish later. Same thing with White Zombie. White Zombie actually started out as like a New York noise band. It was interesting to go back to their records.
Up there with Live Skull, and who I always loved much better than White Zombie. And I was shocked that I thought Live Skull had it all. And they just, you know. And I had a friend in White Zombie, Sean Uselt. So I was shocked that they actually made it, so.
You also know it was a stretch, too, by the fact that he took so long visiting the Coney Island Freak Show. It's like, come on. You don't have enough stuff to investigate.
I got kind of nostalgic for that. That actually hit me. Man, look at that Coney Island.
Well, that does bring us to the first segment of the episode, which is they go visit Donnie Vomit, keeper of a freak show in Coney Island. I don't know if we're allowed to say freak show anymore, but I'm gonna risk it. And... you know, they connect us to P.T. Barnum and this tradition of horror, shock, entertainment. And heavy metal really has, at least in our lifetimes, kind of taken that niche. You know, like circus performers aren't a big thing. You had the Jim Rose sideshow. What did the Jim Rose, whatever he called it, that toured with Lollapalooza and shot Homer Simpson in the stomach with a cannonball and everything. But that's like the last time freaks shows have had any kind of cultural relevance. The only time in my lifetime they've had any kind of relevance. So, yeah, I don't know. I kind of saw...
And that was a resurgence up there with burlesque and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. You know, swing dancing, and now they have...
There's
this
annoying
places.
Stuff.
The fourth ska revival.
Yeah.
I'm not a stripper. I'm burlesque dancer. It's on a higher level.
Yeah. No, as soon as, pole dancing classes for housewives, the dream was over, you know?
Oh, I mean, easy. That's bringing money into my household here. Easy.
Hey.
that's funny. Well, instead of saying that's an art that should be respected, it's bringing money into my.
Hey, that I respect. But she's on the right side of the transaction. You know, it's like it's like the guys that I knew that were, you know, Cabela's, the hunting supply.
Yes.
Empire. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Their sons opened one of the big rehearsal studios in Austin. So just the entrepreneurial gene, these were the disowned heavy metal sons. And they were like, hey, we need a place to practice. I'm going to buy a warehouse and turn it into, you know, and then money just rolled right in. Like the Cabela family cannot stop printing money. Yeah. But so she's on the right side of the transaction by teaching the classes. See, that's no wrong with that. Anything else we want to say about Coney Island, the freak show tradition, other than that's not really relevant to the topic at hand?
Oh, it was. Oh, okay.
Well,
no, go ahead.
There's one fantastic scene. Like where I said, I'm driven to distraction by the fact that Canadian TV apparently can't afford to get him to the shows. They somehow have to impress us with how he gets to the shows. So we see him in planes. We see him walking the thing. They should actually have fun with it. He should ride a bicycle every now and then. But there's a great scene where they focus on Coney Island, where he's walking this way, and like the perfect fat hair polar guy with the Adidas shorts is going that way, and it was just such a beautiful scene. I was like,
okay. That made me miss Brooklyn. I think that was the thing.
Exactly.
Nothing like that in Montclair. And so, I mean, anything they missed with the Coney Island thing? Like, are y'all familiar with the Grand Guignol tradition in France, where they had the 19th century? Huh? Say it right.
Guignol.
No, I'll take it. I can't. You know, I've been trying all day. I listened to it on YouTube several times, but that was a cool thing where they.
UIGN Nul.
Nul.
Yeah.
Grand Guignol.
Yeah.
Well, that wasn't bad. But, so that was a big thing in 19th century France where they had the decadence and they had kind of cabaret music and these bloody, horrific playlets. They could have mentioned that, but I don't know that. I think Carney's is much more American than P.T. Barnum. P.T. Barnum,
But they dropped the fucking ball, right? Because the Carney tradition that was most directly connected to heavy metal was the geeks, right? And the geeks were the low people on the totem pole at the freak show that would just bite the heads off of animals. And that was super apropos given, you know. Technically, Alice Cooper didn't bite the head off the chicken, but
Ozzy Osbourne did bite the head off a bat. So,
accidentally,
drunkenly, had to get a lot of rabies shots there. Yeah. Then they bring into rock and roll.
He thought it was rubber. He said,
"I'm not sure." There's no telling what he was thinking. And if you notice, they had Ozzy in the shock rock category on his little chart, which.
They had the New York Dolls too, and didn't. You know.
Yeah, they had the Dolls there instead.
Take this a little bit off the side. Did you see that the woman from the cover of the Black Sabbath record is now a crazy anti-vaxxer?
No, the first Black Sabbath record, the woman in the background. That's fitting.
She looks amazingly. She looks amazingly good for somebody who's probably in the 70s. You know.
Well, that's what probably the blood of innocence. Magic. Yeah.
Exactly. Elizabeth Bathory swore by it.
Right.
Tub
that's right.
After tub.
Tub after tub.
Cyndi Lauper was on that list, wasn't she? She was on the PMRC list when they did that segment.
You're correct.
Cyndi Lauper's on the list. Yeah. Craziness.
Well, Shebop was, you know, talking about female self-pleasure, a very forbidden topic, one that upset Mrs. Gore in particular. So then they take it into the roots of rock and roll, and they flash Elvis on the screen, but they zero in on Little Richard, which is fine. Little Richard was totally shocking, and Lemmy, the number one Little Richard fan in the world, gets to talk about
in his Nazi regalia.
I know. He would punch people though if they said something crazy like Jerry Lee Lewis was better than Little Richard, or they'd like Chuck Berry better than Little Richard, like Lemmy would throw down. And
they dropped the ball on this one because Little Richard he had this antecedent, and James Blood Olmer talked about this It was this crazy performer who was back in the 40s, was bald, this woman. And she would wear these kind of crazy wigs. And in the middle of the show, she'd be hooting and hollering. And then she would rip off the wig to reveal this bald head. And she influenced, she influenced Little Richard. I remember him talking about it as well. I'm trying to remember her name, like Crazy Zelda, some shit like that. It was, you know.
Was it the gospel guitar player whose name I'm now forgetting that I did a whole episode on?
I don't know.
No,
we're both old and unlikely to remember.
Yes, and didn't do our homework. I'm not throwing any fingers. I'm just saying. But Lemmy has a great quote with Little Richard came from Macon, Georgia. Can you imagine being black and gay in Macon, Georgia in 1947, putting on a dress with a pencil mustache and a Marcel wig, right? Jesus Christ, it's bad enough being gay there now, I imagine. So,
And Little Richard wasn't doing this shit just in the house. He talks about running on the street and just like, or just on the stage. He was like, hey, this is me. I'm out now, you know, running down the store, whatever. That's the way he wanted to roll. So.
Yep. And you know, he pulled it off. Nobody killed Little Richard. I think Little Richard deserves the props. Definitely was shocking. And then they bring in Screamin' Jay Hawkins, which is where it gets gothic. And I'm glad they gave him some shine. Screamin' Jay is a really interesting character. Like, he only had the one hit song. It wasn't even a hit. It was a jukebox hit. I Put a Spell on You sold tons of records on jukeboxes, but they didn't play it on the radio. Mm. Wasn't on the charts. He was pretty much totally underground. And, you know, the 50s was this weird period for horror where even the universal monsters from the 30s were kind of too scary for the 50s. Like, they watered down horror movies. They had sci-fi horror movies like The Creature from the Black Lagoon and stuff. But the, you know, the old school Frankenstein, Dracula, and the Wolfman stuff from the 30s and 40s was still big in the 50s. So Screamin' Jay was able to just kind of recycle that stuff. Mm. And, you know, his whole act of being in a coffin. Although the one thing they didn't bring up that I thought they should have with Screamin' Jay was, you know, he was a trained opera singer. And so even though his working background was in kind of like jump blues, played with a guy named Tiny Grimes, who was kind of straddling that line between jazz and R&B as the icebergs were drifting apart, and Screamin' Jay was his lead vocalist, and then got drunk in the studio, or got somebody got him drunk in the studio to do the Screamin' I Got a Spell on You, and became Screamin' Jay, and he just went with it for his whole career, such as it was.
Too bad we don't know anybody who's actually written a book on Screamin' Jay. You know anybody like that?
I've interviewed a guy who wrote a book on Screamin' Jay.
What book was that?
It was Screamin' Jay Hawkins, I think was the title of it. Steve Burr.
Yeah. Did you read the foreword to that?
I did. Written by somebody very familiar, one of Eugene S. Robinson.
There you go. put some respect on that.
That's right. And then they get to the crazy world of Arthur Brown, who is right on the edge. He's musically, if you go back, the record's not bad, but it's not heavy metal. It's not even heavy rock. It's real organ heavy. But his live show was totally killer. And you know, had the fire dress on his head, the Inca headdress with the flames, and put on a killer psychedelic live show. And
I say he looks pretty good, too.
Yeah, it did 10 years ago. I think he might have passed since then, but yeah, he looks pretty good on the show. And I think deserves his props, because he was out there at the same time as Hendrix and Cream and all this stuff, and Fire was a huge hit both sides of the Atlantic. And then his band quit on him after the US tour, and you know, one of these people how does a one hit wonder happen? Ask Arthur Brown. You run off your band and you take 2 years off, come back with a prog rock band and nobody cares. So, you know, but he's more talented than you might think, and the album's better than you might assume. It's not, I've definitely heard one hit wonders who couldn't fill out a whole album with entertaining stuff. And
you mean it's not Linkin Park, but
well, it's not, you know, it never worked with Rick Rubin. So, I'm telling you, you guys, the kids are laughing at you for your disrespect of Linkin Park.
Yeah, all the kids, you know.
My kids don't even know Tupac and Nirvana. I'm like, you know, Nirvana, what? Like, yeah, they're like, oh, that's a shirt. That's like Hot Topic shirt, right?
It's yeah, like, the thing,
Tupac,
the Wu-Tang Clan and Nirvana are just t-shirts that, yeah, that people wear in some context. So, and I said, shoot, like the Ramones? Shoot. They said, no, nobody even wears Ramones shirts anymore. So, yeah, what are you going to do? Yeah. But now we come to Alice Cooper. And I don't know about y'all, but when I was a little kid in the 70s, the rumors about Alice Cooper were endless. And the yokels in my hometown were terrified of Alice Cooper. And also the whole gender thing was a big part of, in their imagination. The, you know, the Alice Cooper was a witch and he's a dude, but he's named Alice Cooper and, you know, all this stuff. He's the reincarnated spirit of this dead witch. And there was always a problem with the fact that originally Alice Cooper was a band and he was Vincent, the lead singer. And then the identities just got conflated. And the money people figured out, hey, we can just fire the band and make this guy Alice Cooper, and you know the rest.
Weren't they art school students too? Like that's the thing I had heard for a while was the fact that they were like kind of art school guys.
I don't believe so. I thought they were more like rockers.
Go on ahead, you keep on talking.
But yeah, look it up. I don't know. I don't know that one. I mean, I know that Vincent Fournier, I think is his name, that we now know as Alice Cooper, was from Detroit, but the band, I think, actually got going in Arizona and Central California, were sort of affiliated with Frank Zappa, and did hard rock. And they're, I mean, you know, for people that are into late 60s hard rock, I think they're pretty well respected. But their stage show was what got them where they got. And they played in Detroit a lot with the MC5 and Iggy and everything else, but their show was much more theatrical and controlled than those guys, even though it was much more notorious because of the guillotine and the infamous chicken thing at the festival where somehow a chicken ends up on stage, Alice throws it in the crowd, doesn't know chickens can't fly, and the kids in the wheelchairs in the front rows rip the chickens to pieces. I liked that part. You know, but the thing, it's interesting to me in retrospect, Alice Cooper, because he had a couple of radio hits and ends up on the Muppet Show.
I don't know.
Yeah. And he played golf with like Glenn Campbell. Him and Glenn Campbell were lifelong golfing buddies until Glenn Campbell's passing. He played golf with Groucho Marx.
Yeah.
What about, you know, and he becomes this total showbiz guy, whereas Iggy and MC5 crash and burn. The thing I want to know is, like, if you were there at the time, did you see Alice Cooper in the same vein as MC5 and Iggy and the Stooges? If you were seeing them in the Grande Ballroom, did it all seem of a piece? Or did Alice Cooper even then seem more showbiz? Like, why didn't he get tainted with the punk rock thing? Was it just because punk? I mean, that's kind of my big question. It's like the MC5 flamed out because of politics and heroin. Iggy flamed out because of heroin and heroin. If they'd had their shit together, would they have been bigger? Or was punk just not?
I think that, no, I think that he looks so much to me like Steve Bader's. If you actually Alice? Think about it. Yeah. Yeah. He had the same sort of Steve Bader's vibe, and they were from sort of the same part of the country, that it was just kind of like, why would I listen to Alice Cooper? I could listen to Steve Bader's, the Dead Boys. And Steve Bader's was doing stuff like, you know, they said the only thing that you do is shocking is commit suicide on stage. I've seen the Dead Boys. I seen Steve Bader's almost kill himself twice. Not once, but twice. So I have to assume this is part of the act. He throws the mic over the rafters, wraps it around his neck, goes limp. Some stagehand has to run out and get him. I know a little bit something about people getting choked into unconsciousness, and he really went to, you know, Valhalla for a second. You know, they unlash it. This is a standard part of his show, and they look so much alike. I don't know. You know, I mean, there's an air of ham theatricality of Alice that anybody paying attention in the 70s got immediately. You know, I mean, maybe in you know, Borger, Texas, people were actually afraid, but nobody, you know. I don't think the rockers
weren't afraid. And I can remember my brother and his friends when Welcome to My Nightmare, the first Alice Cooper solo album without the band, came out. And it was one of those, you know, gather around the stereo with the new record, and the thumbs were all down, and, you know, they didn't even make it to the record. I can recall I was given the record before the listening party was over. It was in my collection. So, yeah. But I think Alice Cooper was also seven years before the Dead Boys. I mean, you know.
People were much more scared of Venom, which they get into later on in the thing. I mean, I remember before Venom toured with Black Flag, people were actually like having like were scared to like listen to the record alone, and it was like a lot of weirdness. Them and Christian Death from LA, which is not a heavy metal band at all, but had the same sort of like creepy thing that people were like, "This is heavy shit." So
yeah, I mean, the '80s were a big time for Satanic Panic, but the '70s were too. And I mean, even the Beatles had a weird vibe in the '70s. You know, when I was a little kid. And I thought Patty Hearst had been kidnapped by Mr. and Mrs. Manson, and they had her in the closet. Like when I heard the Manson family, I thought it was like Ma and Pa Kettle, except their name was Manson, and they had kidnapped this Patty Hearst figure.
Right.
And the rumors I was hearing about the Beatles, you know, like somebody died in the band, and their secret messages on an album cover, and if you peel the album cover off, they're naked underneath, and you know, and they're devil worshippers, and they started a cult in Los Angeles, and people were murdered, and their secret messages on the records, and if you play them backwards, it says, you know, kill Jesus, and all this stuff, and there was definitely this heavy vibe around the Beatles, and later on, you know, I discovered, oh, there was a record that they had to recall and put a different cover on, and somebody did die. You know, he was a bass player that was not in the band. You know, he was in the band.
Maybe they were satanic.
Well, you know, I mean, Yoko Ono was way into the occult, and they did put secret messages in their records.
And Robert Plant, I remember people postulating that Robert Plant's the death of his kids was a satanic sacrifice. I remember that.
Yep. And Jimmy Page was definitely into Aleister Crowley in a big way. Yep. I mean, he bought houses Aleister Crowley had lived in. He bought manuscripts Aleister Crowley had handwritten. He bought robes that Aleister Crowley had done rituals in. So, you know. yeah, you know. But it is what it is. But that brings us to the next big fish, which they kind of skipped over. They talked about it a little bit in the American Hard Rock episode with Daryl Smith, but they have to go back for more Kiss in this category. And as somebody who was 8 in 1977, for my generation, you can't overstate the importance of Kiss. I mean, we had the lunch boxes, we wore the makeup, we all listened to all the records. Like, I can't even evaluate, like, is Kiss's music any good, because I know every song by heart. So, of course, it sounds good, you know? That's what music is. It's Kiss, you know?
And you want to shout it out loud.
I do. Party all night, you know? And they do get to the kind of the conflict, though, that they had the makeup, they had the stage act, but then their material is just standard issue. It could have been Black Oak Arkansas or 38 Special or any 70s band could have been doing those songs. Like, they had no... they weren't creating any kind of mythos or whatever with their lyrics and stuff, except for the mythos that every woman wants to sleep with Gene Simmons. And, you know, like, some of that stuff is extremely cringe. Were you too old and too cool for Kiss, Eugene?
No, I wasn't a kid. I think I was 14 when Destroyer came out. So I was 14 in 76. And I liked it. I liked it. I was, you know, that I sort of, they lost me a little bit with Beth.
you know, they lost a lot of people with Beth, but I played that for my mom. I can remember, like, you know, Mom, look, see, they're actually talented. Look. And
yeah, Mom was impressed. We should have seen that coming. I mean, when the song was called Beth, it was very different vibe than God of Thunder, right? So
indeed. It was on that same album, you know.
Yeah.
And my older brother was into the first three albums, and then I got him Kiss Alive for his birthday, and he's made a big ceremony of, I have all these songs, I'm taking it back to the store, which he lived to humiliate me at Christmas and birthdays. Like, any time I bought him a record, and then when Destroyer came out, it was too popular and too many little kids were into it. So you know, so I had to bug him to borrow the record from a friend. Then I didn't get to listen to it till bedtime, and I fell asleep before the intro to Detroit Rock City was over. But, you know, because it's got the guy starting his car and the whole, you know, Same thing happened to me when I begged him to borrow the White Album from a friend. You know, like I was all ready to hear Satanic Messages because I've been reading Helter Skelter and everything. And I don't think I made it through Back in the USSR before I fell asleep. And then he had to return the record. So.
What was the first Beatles record you owned?
That I owned? Well, my elder sister had the blue one and the red one, you know. Mm. And then
I got Rubber Soul as a gift in 1970, I believe.
Huh. Well, what was your reaction to that one?
I enjoyed it. I weirdly enough, my favorite songs on it were George Harrison's songs.
Interesting. I would have thought that Rubber Soul would have been pretty out of fashion in 1970, but still a good record.
Not in Cobble Hill, Brooklyn.
Yeah, because my older brothers tended to have the ones with mustaches and beards on the covers. And I don't know whose they were, my sisters or my brothers. And none of my brothers were really, they were all too young for the Beatles, you know? Like they were that generation of kids that their mom dragged them to Beatles parties or whatever, and they didn't think the Beatles were cool. And in the 70s, not digging. My sister, though, was like, the Beatles were right up there with Bread and Jim Croce and, you know, the Queen. She was also my entree.
You the youngest? Are you the youngest?
Oh, yeah, by 10 years. I'm 10 years younger than everybody else. So
That explains so much.
It does.
It does, yes.
When you're counting,
I am the oldest.
Of course, as we can tell. Alexi, though, what's your Kiss? Where were you? How old were you when Kiss?
It was in elementary school. I do remember when the Phantom of the Park came out. Was that the one?
Yep.
And then, see that's like, wow! Like everybody wanted to, you know, to play pretending. You went from pretending to Star Wars, pretending you were like Kiss. Like, which member of Kiss were you, and all this kind of stuff.
And which one were you?
I think because my name was Alexi, I had to be Ace. You know, Ace
I was
Frehley.
Always Ace. I like Ace.
And know. So, but that didn't last that long, though. But I didn't get any of it. My cousin, her parents got divorced, and her father would just show up on the playground and said, Alexi, when you see her, give her this. And I was like, oh, okay. You know, like, and I was like, here you go. And it was like Kiss dolls, right? But I wanted them, but like he was buying Kiss dolls for her. And I was like, here you go. Your dad came. And it's like, he shouldn't be around. You know, it's like one of these things where he had no custody and wasn't supposed to be around. And, you know, so he'd give her the Kiss dolls. Here you go. And she wouldn't want it. She's like, oh, okay.
That's a heartbreaker. Heartbreaker. Yeah. I mean, Kiss was. All my friends were more into Kiss than I was. I liked Queen better, actually. And I kept not getting the right Kiss records. Like, my friend down the street had all the Kiss records.
Jeez,
so, like, I was so excited that I got double platinum and I ran down the street with it. I got the new Kiss records.
Oh,
like,
no.
I have all these songs. Exact same thing my big brother did. I have all these songs. Like, you know, it just, like, crushed me. But double platinum was a pretty good record. I mean,
that was like me and baseball cards. But people would always say, you know, Bucky Dent's a great player. And so I traded, you know, give me the Bucky Dent because he was crappy in the late
60s. You traded away Catfish Hunter and Reggie Jackson for Bucky Dent.
And then, of course, Bucky Dent got good. But I'd already figured out I had been snookered and threw it all on my baseball cards.
Oh,
man.
Painful stuff. Yeah. So... But Kiss's big downfall, and they get into it with the lunchboxes and how their audience changed from cool guys to teenagers to little kids, which is pretty hard to carry. Like, by the time your audience is 8 year olds, that's kind of going to put off other audiences. But they didn't get into the fact that they put out 4 really crappy solo albums at the same time, which they went from being the biggest band in the world to every remainder bin in the country was full of those Kiss solo records forever. I mean, you could find those things used for 15 years. And so then, you know, when they tried to recover by going disco, I mean, they had a hit single, but they never recovered the momentum from those solo albums. And those solo albums, oh my God. The Ace Frehley one's okay, but like the Gene Simmons one, it's like Gene trying to prove he's an all-around entertainer. And it's atrocious. And Peter Criss's album is what you would expect from the guy who sang Beth. So, you know, So they worked hard. They earned it. They had a great gimmick. It was perfect for, it was catnip for little kids. They
from wrote Brooklyn. It
for, or anywhere. And Borger. As well, although it's
pretty
the band was from from Brooklyn.
The band was from Brooklyn. Yeah. Some of them were, but they were put together in Manhattan, you know. I mean,
you can't take it away. Gene Simmons.
Brooklyn. Trying to claim him for Long Island. I know you love your home island. But
jeez.
He's a bridge and tunnel guy. What are you gonna do? What are you gonna do? Surprised you're not talking to Twisted Sister, who could have had a slot on this episode and didn't.
Yeah.
But when we come back, we'll take it into the 80s with Venom and Merciful Fate, kind of underground for this series, and then into the 90s with Marilyn Manson, and into the 2000s with Rammstein, which is kind of an interesting choice.
Oh, so, Slipknot.
And I forgot Slipknot, who could have easily been on the new metal episode, but we're not. So we'll talk about that when we continue.
And now, a word from our sponsors.
And we're back to continue our discussion of shock rock and carry it into the 80s, 90s, and 2000s. So when we left off, Kiss and Alice Cooper had pretty much wrung the washcloth dry on shock rock in the 70s. Would shock rock recover and find new angles in the 80s? Rest assured, thanks to Venom and Merciful Fate featuring vocalist King Diamond, they did, and the new angle was Satanism. Not hinting at it, not wearing crosses like Black Sabbath did, but just out and out upside down crosses, pentagrams, devil faces, the whole bit.
Corpse and paint.
Corpse paint, King Diamond did corpse paint, but Venom, no corpse paint.
Paintless. Yeah, he had the 666 and the little teardrop thing on his face, you know, the whole...
Yeah. So Sam Dunn was frightened. A young Sam Dunn was frightened by both Venom and Merciful Fate. And I have to cut him some slack, because in the 80s, I don't know about y'all, but where I came from, we believed a lot of silly rumors that came down the pike. I mean, you know.
Well, Venom had that, you know, had that thing until they toured with Black Flag. And Henry, I remember, came back and was like, those guys are about as scary as a Vincent Price movie. And that was the end. That was the end of that. They were shocked at Black Flag's, you know, I mean, that was the tour. Black Flag was fist fighting with skinheads. And it was just a lot of real world chaos that the, you know, fairly older guys in Venom were not ready for. But they were theoretically scary.
Yeah, the album covers were scary.
They used incantations and sacrificing animals, not live thuggery and buggery, if you will.
That's right. Civilized Satanism. and musically, they were like real Motorhead ripoffs. I mean, they were not one of your more technically advanced new wave of British heavy metal type bands. But the album covers were great. The black metal album...
And the lyrics,
you know, yeah,
the lyrics, yeah,
lyrics are quite solid.
They successfully created a kind of mystique around their whole shtick that was actually fairly affecting. You know, like I remember listening to that first Venom record, and it actually felt like you were doing. It was like same feeling like Christian death. Like you felt like like this is some shit, you know, this is like something, you know. I mean, those are the days where people were putting satanic chants on, like Iggy has that song with a hey hoorah ha, when they do all these supposedly satanic chants. That was a little heavy back then, you know.
Yeah, early 80s, you know, we weren't quite ready for, well, I guess we were totally primed and ready for this kind of Satanism, because Kiss had the whole Knights in Satan Service rumor and stuff. Yep. But like the guy from Cradle of Filth points out.
You heard Knights? I remember when I was a kid, it was called Kids in Satan Service.
Oh, yeah. I mean, come on. It was Knights.
Yeah, and I heard Kids too, so.
You heard Kids? That must have been the East Coast in Texas.
Well, yeah, in the East Coast. You had Ricky Casso, who, if you remember, stabbed a friend to death in the woods out on Long Island, and said, you know, it presumably said to him right before he stabbed him to death, the drug deal gone awry, Say You Love Satan, which became the name of a biography about Ricky Casso, who then later hanged himself in a jail cell. But he became kind of like guys like Nick Zedd, the dearly departed Nick Zedd. I think he actually did a film with supposed a Ricky Casso character. And you know, you got to remember Sonic Youth, who we know later for this kind of, you know, coffee shop cool. Their first big hit, as far as I knew, was Death Valley 69, where they filmed Running Around the Hills with the Manson family, where it was a whole, you know, alternative serial killer as alternative icon type era.
Yeah, and that was more on the punk side, though. I think you're right that the Venom was more theatrical, and Vincent Price is a good comparison point. And then King Diamond and Merciful Fate. They were Danish for one thing, so that the musically they were more like in that power metal Scorpions except kind of vein. I dug them at the time. I mean, the vocals were ridiculous, but it was clearly novel, and I mean, it was unmistakable. You put a Merciful Fate tape on, you knew it was Merciful Fate. I mean, King Diamond definitely had a unique branding, but again, pretty minor figures. Like, I think you could make a run at Motley Crue being the biggest shock rock act of the 80s on the metal scene. I mean, you know, setting their pants on fire, and they, you know, they had Shout at the Devil and the whole, I remember the beginning of the second album, you know, ooh, and you know, I had the whole sort of satanic thing. And I know the preachers in my hometown were much more upset about Motley Crue than Venom or Merciful Fate. I mean, I think I was the only kid in my town that knew who Venom was for a long time. I mean, until I told my friends, but you know, everybody knew who Motley Crue was.
We played with King Diamond, and that was one of the most flipped out shows that Oxbow has ever played. And we used to have Tom Dobroff was in, so it had to be before Oxbow Serenade in Red. So maybe 2002.
Okay, so way late.
Yeah, and it devolved into the police being called and the riot squad and all that stuff, not because of King Diamond, but it was a weird juxtaposition. Like, we played, and then King Diamond, and they were sort of instrumental in the riot kicking off, because they made the promoter cut our sound. So I flipped out and pulled the PA stacks into the crowd and beat up the bouncers. And of course, I was naked when I did all this. So, you know, and after the police came and dragged me out, of course, then King Diamond comes on stage and they put this like model, naked girl model passed out over this kind of altar and these little scary candles. And people were like, what about the crazy Negro they just took out? That shit was scary. This is not scary, you know? So it was a weird juxtaposition. But I do have to say that the guy, Tom, who's that guy from Merciful Fate? The guy, Tom, Celtic Cross. He was
Celtic
a great
Cross.
Guy.
Yeah, Tom.
Yeah. What's his name?
Were they on the same bill?
No, but we played with him in Switzerland, and he was a really phenomenal guy. So I don't want to make it out like I'm a satanic hater. It's just that I didn't get along with King Diamond and his crew. Fuck them. Sorry. Yeah. I mean, had to drag us into personal vendetta, but.
Well, we know. I mean, you know, I always bring up the story of the guy, the real-life gravedigger, who was in a production of Hamlet with Laurence Olivier. And somebody asked him, what's the play about? He said, it's about a gravedigger who meets a prince. That's every Eugene story. What's the show about? Oh, it's about some bands that play with Oxbow.
Right. Yeah. No, but I have to say, but from the interview with him, I liked him more than I thought I ever would. And it's too bad that things ended up that evening the way they did. He seemed like a pretty nice guy.
Well, you know, for an avowed Satanist. And I also thought it was amusing that Sam Dunn was sort of, when he was amused that King Diamond was living in a Dallas suburb, and he's like, there's nothing satanic about that. It's like, I was thinking, obviously you've spent less time in Dallas suburbs than I have, because there's a that shit is Satan country. I just gotta say,
let's go back to 1963, bro.
Hey, you know, there's that. But Dallas is a lot like sort of a junior LA, and you see a lot of those like old Hollywood weirdo types in Dallas sometimes, if you know where to look, and a lot of creepiness. But this whole bit with this avowed Satanism is Anton LaVey's brand of Satanism, which is essentially Ayn Rand's brand of, you know, selfishness. Do what you want, what makes you happy, and grab and take and everything, and don't worry about anybody else, less than some kind of truly occult belief in supernatural forces or anything like that, or the old school, you know, Catholic kind of Satanism. But it definitely freaked people out in the 80s. And that brings us to the PMRC, the Parents Musical Resource Center.
Resource Center.
Yeah. Tipper Gore and who was the other big wife? So that's the wife of Al Gore, who was a senator at the time. I think it was, I want to say Sam Nunn's wife. It was a Republican senator, senator's wife. That was the thing. But basically, they paint the PMRC as creating their own backlash, or inadvertently giving bands like King Diamond a big break by putting them in the Filthy 15. And it's totally true. Like, you had all these bands like Prince and Madonna and Motley Crue that were like, you know, chart-topping platinum acts. And then you had Venom and King Diamond and the Mentors. Remember, the Mentors had a big, their entire run of fame was thanks to the PMRC. I mean, you know,
it's a sandwich above, one below and one above. Sorry.
yes. And the infamous line.
But Ola, you mentioned the Mentors, and I'm sort of shocked that they didn't mention Gigi Allen. And I know what you're going to say. Gigi Allen was more punk, but I remember when I had a magazine in the old days and got the first demo tapes from Gigi Allen, they were heavily rock influenced. He was a metal guy. It just happened to be that the punks liked him more, right?
I would say he was more of a hard rock guy than a metal guy, though.
Okay. I mean, okay. Yeah, you know, the stuff that he, his brother Merle sent me, I mean, we're talking 81 at that point. It, to my ear at this point, it was just shitty metal. But I could also see just shitty rock. I thought it was garbage and threw it away.
Yeah. The thing about Gigi, when I saw him, I mean, first off, he had no popular profile when he was alive.
Like,
his claim to fame comes from the movie Hated.
That's not true.
He had an underground profile. I mean, he had a big underground profile. He was a cult thing. I mean, you know, I had a friend who went out of town for the weekend and came home, and his roommates were all excited. Dude, we booked Gigi Allen to come play a show, and he's going to stay in our house. And so it made for some hilarious stories. My friend put a padlock on his door. Still came home to Gigi and an extremely repulsive woman in bed in his room, but in his room through the padlock. They busted the padlock off the door to his bedroom, but he felt like he got off light compared to his roommate, who tried to take a bath one morning at 5 a.m. thinking he could slip in and quietly clean himself. And then next thing he knows, Gigi's sitting on the toilet kind of talking about how he wants to mentor him and et cetera. And then the next thing he saw was, he hears a scream, looks out the window, and sees his roommate running across the grocery store parking lot that's behind their house, and Gigi following behind him like Harpo Marx chasing a dancing girl, you know. But while Gigi was in town, he played a party. Like, the big show that they booked, Gigi showed up with some crackheads, took the entire gate, and disappeared. No show whatsoever. But the next night, he played a party at somebody's house and just did a straight rock show. And it was a really good kick-ass rock show. I was totally impressed.
Did he have the crackheads operating as groupies or as part of the crew or
whatever.
Roadies. I'm my roadies.
You know, they drove him to the venue and helped him, you know, and then he absconded with the gate, and then they helped. I'm sure they helped him spend it. But back to the PMRC. I mean, yeah. With Gigi, and they also they interviewed Guar, Odorous Arungus from Guar, but they didn't talk about Guar.
Dave Brocky, rest in peace.
Yeah, the late great, and Guar, one of the great live acts of that or any era, and all homemade, do it yourself, you know. Art students from Richmond, Virginia, just doing some amazingly ridiculous stuff. But Guar never had a hit record. I don't think they were ever on a major label. So I can see why they didn't get featured here other than talking. And they had White Zombie on this episode also, you know, which was fitting. But I want the thing about PMRC I wanted to get in was they basically just point out that PMRC was a net negative for what they wanted to do, which their goal was to give parents more control over what kids listen to. And what they did was give kids an easier way to find, these are the cool cassettes or CDs I want to buy and put this voice in my head. But nowadays, with our surveillance state and our tech monopolies, those explicit labels that they put on everything, that has become a key part of this control apparatus. And even podcasts like ours, that thanks to your lack of self-control, I have to label ours explicit. So Spotify and the other podcast monopolies, you know, actually some countries, they won't even let you listen to explicit podcasts. So
I've never labeled anything we've done as explicit.
Well, that's on YouTube and that, but when you're doing the audio only and the podcast, Apple
in particular, so you get distracted by the audio with the pretties. That's the thing.
Exactly. Hey, exactly.
You don't get my lack of self-control. You have no idea.
Sir, what part of Naked Negro attacking people in the crowd did you not understand?
Pulling the PA down onto the crowd.
So
that takes us to the 80s, which I think we can all agree the 80s were not a great era for shock rock. That the 60s, 70s, and 90s all smoked the 80s on the shock rock sweepstakes. Anybody want to argue?
Yeah, because there was still, I mean, I remember in the 80s, they were still referencing stuff from the 70s. And, you know, it wasn't until, I guess, it was still referencing the 70s. And then the whole Satan Panic thing, it dovetailed into that, which, again, could not compare to the Ozzy Osbourne stories and Alice Cooper with the chicken. Like, the big stories were, even Led Zeppelin with the shark. I mean, there were no stories coming that I recalled at the time as impressionable youth could compare to the stuff that you were hearing from the 70s.
Yeah, and I think a lot of that is because punk was the biggest, most shocking thing of this era and kind of stole metal's thunder on that thing. And I think like what Eugene was talking about with the Venom Black Flag collision, punk was just so much more intense. And that's where thrash, you know, was an advance for metal, because suddenly you had slam dancing and moshing, and you had bands like Slayer, Metallica that were comfortable with that kind of thing and that could hang with punk crowds, whereas the older metal bands were taken aback, you know, and couldn't handle the spitting and the slamming and all that stuff. But this brings us to the 90s, the alternative grungy alt rock 90s, and Marilyn Manson, who musically this category is basically made for Marilyn Manson. I mean, it's a lot like Kiss in that musically not that significant, but really had the shtick down and the act. Just the name alone was pretty genius. I mean, Marilyn Manson, you know, stick it together.
I don't know, man. It made me think of Elvis Costello. I just tried and tried and tried to like him. I just couldn't do it. My wife is actually had been one of the spooky kids, and he would stay with them when he would go to Poland, so they have a personal connection to the guy. But I tried. I bought Antichrist Superstar, and I was like, what is this shit? I couldn't do it, you know?
Well, that one, I went back and listened to all their albums, which I'd never done before. I was too old to be a Marilyn Manson fan. And it was interesting to me that their first couple of records were guitar rock. But by the time of the what was the one you just said? The Antichrist Superstar. Yeah. By that point, he'd hooked up with Trent Reznor, and he had a pretty industrial sound. And a similar thing happened to White Zombie, where White Zombie actually starts out as a New York underground noise rock band playing, I think we talked about this before, playing with the Swans and Sonic Youth. And then evolved it. Yeah, and Live Skull. And they evolve into more of a metal band, and then get into, they don't get really industrial until like 96 or so, which my memory of White Zombie was basically that they were mostly industrial, you know, rock by the time they got popular. But, you know, and so same thing with Marilyn Manson. I assume that they were always like that, that they were always real Nine Inch Nails or Ministry influence. But, you know, the earlier stuff was pretty much just straight rock. And, you know, I don't think there was anything musically genius ever going on there, but I do think that he clearly created a brand and a character and a persona that clicked with kids in the 90s. And, you know, going up against grunge and nu metal and, you know, all the stuff, hip hop, all the stuff, and just had that lane. I mean, there was like the Marilyn Manson lane. It was very much had it to himself and just absolutely capitalized. And, you know, they talked about that. And I thought it was interesting that Daisy Berkowitz, dude, that was his guitar player, seemed to, I thought, had a more self-aware just understanding of what they were doing. Whereas it seemed more like Marilyn Manson was buying his own BS as far as just repeating his lines of, I'm trying to make people think with my crazy outrageous, you know. And whereas Daisy Berkowitz was like, well, obviously we're baiting people, you know. And then the big Columbine moment comes along and Marilyn blinks, you know, which I think is totally understandable. I mean, every celebrity essentially has this rise and fall arc, almost every celebrity. You know, unless you're Bing Crosby or Irving Berlin or Paul McCartney or something where you just sail through the clouds for 50 years. But most celebrities have this rise and fall and cannot handle the tension and the pressure and everything else. And it seemed like to me, Marilyn Manson was probably just due for it. Like, even if Columbine hadn't happened, he probably was going to pull back and retreat because he'd been so famous and been so controversial, and he'd courted the controversy. And, you know, when he was suddenly headline, you know, like he had been kind of, he wasn't like Kurt Cobain and Eddie Vedder. He wasn't on the cover of Time and Newsweek back when that meant something. You know, he was coming to towns and playing big shows, and he was being protested by the local Christian Jesus freaks, but he was not top of mind. But then after Columbine, he was top of mind, and I don't think he could handle, obviously he couldn't handle it, and he pulled back. And I don't even want to get into all the Me Too allegations and stuff that's come out in more recent eras, you know. But like Trent Reznor and him had a vicious falling out, and Reznor has been shit talking him for decades. So, you know, his critical, he had a lot more critical respect in the 90s and the 2000s when they made this than he does now.
If he had been a student of our, of If the Shoes Fit, I would have advised him to follow his namesake and not blink at Columbine and said, you know, whose fault is it that your kids have fallen into my hands? Right?
Yeah. I'm a product of your society. I mean, he could have just reprised any number of Charles Manson parole hearings and gone to town with it. But, you know, he clearly blinked. And I think that's, it's the classic Mick Jagger at Altamont thing. You know, I mean, Mick Jagger was into a big thing with painting pentagrams on his chest and doing Sympathy for the Devil. And at a time when that really freaked people out. And then he sees the Hell's Angels killing somebody right in front of him, and oh, it's just an act, guys. I'm just an entertainer, you know.
Who's the biggest person that comes to mind that did not blink? I'm talking in terms of commercial success, who had a blinking opportunity, did not. I'm not talking about people who were not commercially like up there. Is there anyone that comes to mind?
Yeah, that did not blink. I mean,
they all blink. I can't.
They all blink. I mean, even John Lennon apologized for the "We're Bigger Than Jesus" thing. You know, I mean, Jim Morrison.
Your famous one, though. Eugene, I think the biggest one, obviously, is not, you know, Jim Morrison, but Vince Neil and
That's right. That's right. That's right.
Which was, for those who...
After he killed the fucking dude from Hanoi Rocks, he says, and he asked him about it, he's like, his band wasn't really going anywhere anyway. Man.
I think that's the biggest, right? That has to be.
Yeah, that's got to be. I can't think of one more disgusting than that one, yeah.
That was some appalling cluelessness. But there wasn't like a big, you know, firestorm of anger over that. I mean, he was a much bigger celebrity in the States than Razzle was. And, you know, the thing is, when we went back, when we did the glam listening, you know, the glam episode, and I went back and I listened to that, Hanoi Rocks is by far the best glam rock band of that era, by miles and miles and miles. I mean, you're talking about four or five really, really good albums.
Which makes it much more vicious than exactly. what Vince said.
Yes. I mean, I can't think of anybody that, you know, after The Who had their disaster show in Cincinnati where 11 people got killed, they were totally contrite and apologetic. Yeah. I can't, you know, Great White, of course, several of them didn't survive that fire. So I can't think of anybody who, you know, went through anything comparable. But we still got to cover Slipknot and Rammstein. So let's move along. So then, you know, they talk about the rise and fall of Marilyn Manson. Then they bring up Slipknot. And to me, Slipknot easily could have fit into the new metal category. Uh-huh. To me, listening to Slipknot's albums, they're like three parts new metal, one part death metal. That's kind of how I saw the recipe. Although they were doing some interesting things. Like I heard things like beats that were referencing what was going on in the English dance scene in the 90s, like jungle and drum and bass kind of stuff. I heard that and I was like, whoa, that's, you know, not something I expected. And most of those new metal bands stayed away from the death metal growling and all that, whereas Slipknot will do whole songs in that style. And they definitely shocked and put on a scary show. Did you guys ever see Slipknot live? Or
no, I never did. I hated them before this show and actually ended up with a huge amount of respect and interest that I didn't have before. I just love the guy's interview. I think he's I'm a big authenticity guy, and it just seemed to me to be really straight up authentic. So I could forgive the mask and the music that didn't interest me very much, but to know that this guy was like, I go out there every night wanting to die. I was like, all right. Guys got some skin in the game.
I had the total opposite effect. I was like, you know, I gave him points for keeping up the act backstage, but I still felt like it was just the difference between his shtick and Insane Clown Posse shtick, I do not see a great difference in, you know, like,
well, that's a mistake. See, I
Juggalos are a way of life.
Juggalos are a fascinating socio-cultural phenomenon, but I've seen both of those groups live, and Slipknot is way, way, way more intense live than Insane Clown Posse. But I don't, the clown mask thing just kills me. I cannot take it seriously. You know, I don't know. When the guy says we're war, that's what we are, and I'm like, no, you're not war. Like, you're a fucking rock band that puts on masks and scares kids. You're not war. I mean, you know, but
that's also, that brings up, you know, I mean, that's how you're laying the groundwork for how hip hop ended up lapping them in terms of, you know, the stakes. And it's gotten bad enough with hip hop where who somebody recently came out and said, like some, like a respected community, Master P maybe came out, or somebody like Master P, and the headline was Master P explains why all these young rappers are getting shot dead. Fundamentally was the headline, and I haven't had a chance to read it yet, but it's risen to the occasion where people are like, whoa, in the last, since Pop Smoke, we got what, 12, 15 guys, bona fide, you know, hit records, guys with millions of dollars just getting popped again and again. And that, it's hard to, you know, dragons and demons and, you know, screaming about how war is on stage when, you know, you got cats who are getting shot to death on stage, right? I mean, you could say Pantera was,
well,
but that was
Dimebag Darrell got shot to death on stage, so yeah. You know, I mean, that was pretty intense. But yeah, there's nothing coming out of metal that compares to hip-hop. I mean, with hip-hop, this latest generation, they're not even making the 27 club. I mean, it's like the 18 and a half club or the 21 club. I mean, it's just horrific. And some of these guys are just complete criminal knuckleheads too. I mean, you got, you know, not any big superstars that I can think of, but multiple people have had, you know, YouTube singles or whatever that were just stone murderers, like a guy who murdered his own crew in some kind of elaborate frame thing. But back to the metal thing, I mean, you know, they cover Slipknot, gave up. I mean, you guys bought it, so pretty good presentation.
A buddy has been living off of Slipknot for years by telling women that he's the bass player for Slipknot. And it's actually,
who's gonna know, right?
Slipknot, Knob.
Well, one thing I did want to point out, though, that when they talk about Clown huffing, keeping a dead crow in a plastic bag and then huffing the fumes before, he totally stole that from a guy named Death, who was in the Norwegian black metal band Mayhem. And Death blew his brains out, and then
he kept it real.
The leader of Mayhem, who was his roommate, then came in and took pictures of the corpse that he later used for an album cover and made some jewelry out of parts of his skull, and then called the police and everything. So, and then of course those guys, that guy later gets murdered by the bass player of Mayhem, who's also the guy from Burzum. So Norwegian black metal keeps it kind of real on a comparable to hip hop level, but Slipknot didn't. And then they bring in Rammstein at the end. Which I don't know, I felt like it was kind of tacked on, but it was appropriate enough. They were big and
Du hast like Rammstein.
The classic, you know, over the top schlocky show with the dildo and the spewing and everything.
I liked them more than I liked them, if that makes sense. Like, I liked the idea.
You liked the idea
than the actual music, so.
Well, yeah, but I mean, like,
I view them as artists. I think that they're doing some kind of agitprop thing. I don't really view them as serious musicians. So,
yeah, it's fun stuff, but I didn't hear anything to me that was new. Like, everything I was hearing them do was something that Liebach or Ministry had done 15, 20 years earlier, you know. Although there was a YouTube clip where they took a video of the Derlevanger battalion attacking a Belarusian village and had a Rammstein soundtrack to it instead of the original Horst Weisel, you know, song Lied or whatever. And they took it off YouTube because it was too good to Nazi propaganda, but it was excellent Nazi propaganda. I have to
say, had your hand lifted up, huh?
Hey, not mine. I'm anti, I'm thief all the way, baby. Have my fists up.
A friend of mine is the one who signed them to the German record label. And an exciting footnote is he was so flying so high after that, right? And then he signs a guy named Biscuit Boy, who they put $2 or $3 million into his video. And I go, how did it do? He goes, well, it didn't do that good. I go, how many records did you sell? He goes, well, you know, 130. I go, 130,000 is not that much. He goes, 130. He said, literally, as he was packing his bags to leave the record label, because they were like, you're not. How do you spend $3 million? It really made me want to track down Biscuit Boy to see what it was like. And I still never have done this.
Well, might have to track it down. That is bad A&R right there, to spend $3 million. You let the band have a hit, then you spend the $3 million on the video. Like, you don't fly that.
Well, he was hot from Rammstein, and then, you know, they give him anything at that point. But
he's hot for Rammstein. Got it bad, so bad. He's hot for Rammstein.
So, final thoughts on shock rock. Is shock rock even a category, or is this just a way to shoehorn these groups that are significant in there? Like, I feel like you really could have put Alice Cooper and Kiss into the 70s American metal episode, and Slipknot could have gone in the new metal. I think they should have had an industrial metal episode, and you could have put Marilyn Manson and White Zombie in there. You know,
my thought watching it is like, they're trying to make a TV show. I got you.
And the stuff, it is significant. It is a big part of metal, but that's it for this episode. We'll be back next time to talk power metal, which is going to be a total learning curve, because these are, like, to me, power metal is Scorpion's Judas Priest, except that kind of, you know, post-Rainbow 70s and early 80s metal that is not yet speed metal. So, like, anything from Judas Priest up through Anvil, I would consider power metal, but apparently there's a whole new generation of European power metal bands, and Sam Dunn is going to learn about it and try to share it, and we'll talk about that next time.
Walking around.
Follow the Let It Roll podcast on Twitter at Let It Rollcast, and check out our website at letitrollpodcast.com. Next week, Nate, Eugene, and Alexi return to discuss power metal. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to more great podcasts at www.pantheonpodcasts.com.